ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिः शृणुयाम देवाः शृणुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुम् स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुं सस्तनूभिः सस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्रवाः स्वस्ति न पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति न पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्थतातु स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्थतातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः Okay. Verse 3. We're still working on verse 3. Shaunako Havai.
Shaunako Havai.
Mahashala. Let's see. Shaunako Havai Mahashalaha. Shaunako Havai Mahashalaha. Angirasam Vidivat. Upasannapaprachha. Kasminnu Bhagavo. Vijñāte. Sarvamidam Vijñātam. Pavatiti. Shaunakaha. I'll read this with the Sunday broken, though we did it last week. Shaunakaha Havai Mahashalaha Angirasam Vidivat Upasannaha Papracha Kasmin Nu Bhagavaha Vignate Sarvam Idam Vignatam Bhavati Iti. Okay. So, Shaunaka approached Upasannaha. Shaunaka approached Vidivat Upasannaha according to Viddi. Viddi means the injunctions or the rules, or the rules of the tradition. So, according to the traditionally, we could say, according to Viddi, as it is enjoined, as it is enjoined by the tradition, Vidivat. Okay? So Shaunaka approached, Shaunaka, who was a Mahashalaha, a great householder. A shala actually is a big, huge room. Like sometimes at the ashram, we'll have what we call the Yajnashala. Or the place where we do the lectures, it'll be like a large room. And so a Mahashala is where you can have a lot of events, a lot of rituals, a lot of gatherings. And so and a person who is a Mahashalaha, it's not that just that they have a huge shala. It's that they also have the means to do all of the rituals that are enjoined for them to do, that they follow Dharma, and that they're a person of means who follows Dharma and who also is somebody who's known to do all of the rituals and things that are required of them as a householder. That's another thing. A Mahashalaha is a householder, a grihastha. Right? So somebody who's married, has family, and is doing all of the rituals and all of the prescribed duties that are enjoined upon him to do. And so this is interesting. So Shaunaka, this Mahashala, this a householder who is known for doing all of the things that are prescribed to him, living a dharmic life, he approached Angirasam, according to Viddi. He's the one who approaches. This itself is very significant because it's not a sannyasi approaching, it's a householder approaching. So this is significant for you to understand who is an adhikari for this knowledge. Who is an adhikari? It's not just somebody who has taken sannyasa, right, who's wearing the orange. That's not the definition of an adhikari, somebody who's a qualified student. A qualified student is somebody who has viveka, vairagya, shamadhamu paratita tiksha. Viveka is that discrimination, who's recognized the problem. Vairagya is the dispassion. So somebody who has those qualifications, a desire, mumukshutvam, a desire for liberation, primary. You can have some viveka and some vairagya, no desire for liberation. If you don't have the mumukshutvam, you're not going to approach the guru, right? So, but to have the mumukshutvam, you do need some viveka where you've discerned the problem. You need some vairagya, some dispassion that's born of that viveka. But to have the viveka, the vairagya, the antakarana shuddhi, a certain equipoise of mind, how do you get that? So here, significant to the Mahashala is somebody who's lived a life of dharma and lived a life where they've done their prescribed duties, whether it be the morning and evening rituals or those things that are expected by them in terms of taking care of their family, taking care of their wife or their husband, taking care of their children, taking care of their parents. All of these prescribed duties, you know, which are taken on as a duty. There's an attitude of it being my duty, my responsibility. And so those duties, those responsibilities are binding in a sense. And those binding responsibilities, even the rituals that one performs on a daily basis, in the morning or in the evening, the rituals that are enjoined upon a person who has the Shraddha in the Vedas. They have Shraddha in the Vedas, so they take these prescriptions seriously. And so those prescribed duties hold the person, right? So that the ragas and dveshas, the likes and dislikes that are going on in a person's mind, right, are held in check by the strength of the prescribed duties. And what's important about that is that then your buddhi, your intellect, your values become stronger than your likes and dislikes. And that's what brings about the antakarana shuddhi. I may want to do something, but I have this duty. And because I have this duty, I can't always do what I want. If I don't have any structure like that, then what I want to do, then I do. There's nothing telling me, there's no structure to hold my mind in check. If the structure is there, then my buddhi, the intellect, becomes strong. Right? And the intellect can decide and say no. Yeah. The value system becomes stronger than the likes and the dislikes. And so that life, full of prescription, full of ritual, full of duties, may in a sense seem burdensome, but in another sense, it's something that brings about a mind that has shanti, has peace, because it's a mind that follows dharma, that has, let's put it this way, a mind that has the strength to follow dharma, the mind that has the strength to say no and is just not carried astray by the whims of your likes and dislikes, that mind enjoys an inner peace. It has a depth. It has a depth of silence. That mind is capable of reflection. That mind is capable of looking out at the world and saying, what is going on? Right? what is this all about? Where is there really happiness? What is the source of happiness? What is the truth of all of this? That mind can inquire. So this is very significant here, that Shaunaka is a Mahashalaha, that he's somebody who is a householder, that lived this a life of duties and prescriptions, and that Mahashala means he was respected as that, right? He was respected as that. He was respected as a dharmi and somebody who lived a life, the life that was enjoined upon him to live. And so this respected householder, Shaunaka, he approached Angirasam. Angirasam now is where we left off in terms of the Sampradaya. Angirasam is the end of the Sampradaya as it has, the teaching tradition has been left off at Angirasam. Now Shaunaka is approaching him. You know, it went through the whole, he was taught by Satyavaha and so on. You know, all the way up to Brahmaji, all the way through up to the Lord. So now Angirasam is there being approached, according to Viddi, by Shaunaka, who's a householder. Shankara, in his commentary, makes an important point here. A person who is a householder has a lot of things enjoined upon him or her, rituals and duties, but especially the karmakanda. There are many rituals and things that are actually enjoined, have to be done. So then, somebody who's like a mimamsaka from the karmakanda will bring up an argument if they were living in Vedic society and say, well, doesn't this mean then that it's not only knowledge, the gain of knowledge that's important here, it's knowledge in conjunction with rituals. Because the householder is enjoined to do all of these rituals, so these rituals must also be important. You know, the rituals must also be important in gaining knowledge. So I should have to keep doing all of these enjoined things and gain knowledge. And the combination of them will bring about an enlightenment. There's a huge argument that goes on here. That argument is something that will go all through the Upanishads and all through Shankara's commentary. Because of this, what is really the source of what really brings about your liberation? What is really going to bring about the liberation? The moksha. What do you have to do to gain the moksha, to gain the liberation? Do you have to do a combination of things, like do some hatha yoga, do some rituals, do some pranayama, do some shravana, and do some of this and that, and have a little potpourri of things you do, some activities, some of which are activities, enjoined activities, and some which have to do with learning, and then how about some meditation practice, you know? So what is actually involved in gaining liberation? That's a very important question. So here, in this Upanishad, why is Shaunaka the one that this whole Upanishad is a dialogue between Angirasam and Shaunaka, a householder who's doing rituals? Why is that? And so there's in the Bhashya, there's a whole commentary on that. And Shankara says, not even in your dreams can any amount of activity or ritual give you knowledge, give you liberation. Not even in your dreams. And the reason is that the nature of the self, and these verses are going to be dealing with this now, the nature of yourself is already achieved. You can't gain it. Karma, doing karma, gives you something. You do a karma, you do a ritual in order to gain something. or to get rid of something, right? Or to cleanse something. You may do rituals and karmas and prayers in order to gain antakarana shuddhi. But then you're doing something to your mind, you're cleaning it. Or you may do karmas and rituals and prayers in order to gain a teacher. Asking for Bhagavan's grace, please give me a teacher to give me this knowledge. So you may get the teacher in front of you, but that's doing something. That's bringing you from point A to point B, or bringing you into the vicinity of a teacher. But just because here's the teacher sitting here, and here you are sitting here, so you are now in the vicinity of each other. But for moksha, knowledge has to take place. Knowledge has to take place. Because the nature of yourself, the nature of yourself is what you need to know in order to be free. Right? Moksha has to do with self-knowledge. Because the self that you are is already free, so there's nothing you can do to become free. You have to know it. And so not even in your dreams can there be anything to do in order to become liberated. You can do many, many things to gain antakarana shuddhi, to gain adequate situation, to gain punya, many, many things that you can do. Many things you can do in many different ways to gain the antakarana shuddhi. And Shaunaka had the antakarana shuddhi because he lived a life of dharma, right? That gave him the shanti that was necessary for him to become a mumukshu so that he could approach a teacher, so that he would even want to approach a teacher, so that he would have the viveka, the discrimination, the vairagya, the mumukshutvam. So that Shaunaka is a mahashala, means he lived a life of dharma, he gained the antakarana shuddhi, he approached a teacher. As a grihastha, he approached a teacher. He may take sannyasa later. He may not. It doesn't. It's irrelevant. What happens to you internally is what is relevant. The adhikaritvam, the being a qualified student, that's what's relevant. Shaunaka became a qualified student because he lived a life of dharma. He approached Angirasan according to Viddhi, you know, sticks in hand. Right? We'll see there's a most famous verse in the Mundaka coming up. On how the student approaches the teacher with samit panihi, right? Sticks in hands. It's just I went over this last week, but sticks in hands, symbolic of saying, please, to your teacher, please give me knowledge. I'm in service to you. You please give me this knowledge. Yeah. There's a shraddha there. It's very, very beautiful. And so he, according to this viddhi, with the right attitude, when you say viddhi, but according to viddhi, it's not just because he came with some sticks. That's not. Shraddha. There's shraddha. Shraddha means there's an attitude there. Shraddha is an attitude, you know, toward the shastra, toward the guru, actually, because Shaunaka approached Angirasam. He approached him, you know, and said, will you teach me this? You know? And he had a question for him. So that he approached him according to Viddhi means he now is accepting that Angirasim as his teacher, right? Shraddha. And Angirasim was taught by his teacher. So there's a sampradaya there. And so Shaunaka wants to gain the knowledge which Angirasam has. So there's two things. There's shraddha toward Angirasam. There's shraddha toward the sampradaya. You know? So that's all. It's all in here. Which it often is in the beginning of an Upanishad. So much is said, you know, to give you the setting and to make you understand the things that are important. The things that here, this particular Upanishad is highlighting, is the Guru taking the Guru Sisha Parampara back to Ishvara. Right? It starts with Brahmaji. So it takes the teaching back to Ishvara. It's It means it's up out of shame. It does not belong to a human being. This knowledge comes from Bhagawan himself. Okay. And then shows the teacher-student sampradaya all the way down now to Shanaka. You know, now showing that now this teaching is going to be taking place. It gives the sampradaya back up to Bhagawan. Now this teaching is going to be taking place because Shanaka, the great householder who had lived a life of Dharma, has approached, following Viddhi, means with Shraddha, has approached Angirasam and asked him for this knowledge. He says, Paprachai. Having approached, according to Viddhi, Paprachya, he asked to Angirasam, Kasminnu Bhagavaha, Hey Bhagavan, to the teacher's respect, Hey Bhagavan, Kasminnu Vignate, when what thing is known, when what thing is known, Sarvam Idam Vignatam Bhavati, all this, Sarvam Idam, all of this is known. When what one thing is known, all this, Sarva means all, Idam this, all of this is known. What is that? So now, a Mahashala has somebody who has been brought up with in a life of Dharma, Vedic life, who has been performing rituals, who knows his Veda, right? Has studied the Vedas. This isn't as true today, but it used to be always true. Would have studied his Veda, which means both the first portion of the Veda, the Karmakanda, and the Jnanakanda, the Upanishads. He would have studied all of that. He would have read all of those words. He would have learned how to do rituals, the rituals that were prescribed. And he would have read all of the Upanishads. He would have even memorized them. So now, in his mind, he would know that such ideas, because especially in the Taittiriya Upanishad, the Chandogya Upanishad, and this Upanishad, such ideas as knowing one thing is that everything is known. Those words are there in the Upanishads. But when you read that, and say now, listen, say you just hear, you read this yourself. You've studied the Vedas, you've learned them by heart. You've even learned all the Upanishads by heart. And in the Upanishad it says, knowing that one thing, everything is as well known. That one thing which is infinite, which is yourself. That one self which is infinite, knowing that everything is as well known. You read that. So now you have those words. You know those words are there. You know Shraddha in the Vedas, Shraddha in the Upanishads. You know now that this is so. There is this there. The Upanishad says so. But you don't have the knowledge that I am that. You have read it. You might have even read Tattvamasi. You are that. You've read it. And you've read all of the Upanishads. And you've read, knowing this one thing, all things are known. But you haven't been taught. The Guru Sisha Parampara, that Sampradaya, which is a teaching methodology that unfolds these Upanishads to make you see, you haven't been exposed to that. And so knowing there is such a thing, Shanaka approaches the teacher. That's one way Shankara deals with this verse. Knowing, because of having studied the Upanishads, he knows there is such a thing. It's in the culture. And so he approaches. He wants to know now. As a mumukshu, he wants to know. Because he approaches the teacher as his guru. When he approaches according to Viddhi, he's asking the teacher, will you please be my guru? Will you please unfold this to me? Will you please teach me this? Will you please teach me this? So he already knows it from having studied, read all the Upanishads, and just hearing within the culture. Another thing is just from with your experience in the world. You can deduce something that this possibility, because you can see from your own experience that all clay pots are made of clay. All gold ornaments are made of gold. Right? Many, 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 many ornaments, one cause. Many, many pots, one clay. Is there one thing like that that is responsible for all of this, is the cause of all of this? So even in that way, you can come upon a question like that. Right? If there is such a thing, which the Upanishads say that there is, and so say Shanaka will know that, let's look at what that would be. If you say, is there one thing, knowing that one thing, if I know that one thing, all things are known. In the world, there's no such thing. In other words, any one object you start to know, you just continue to unfold your ignorance about the nature of that one thing, let alone having it give you knowledge of something else. Right? Because every object in the creation is itself infinitely divisible and infinitely complex as you start to take it apart. That's one problem. So you try to know one thing in the creation and you find that it's impossible to know. And not only that, to get into the middle of it, to try to figure out what is this thing, but what is it all about, you find it's infinitely divisible, so there's no way you can really know it. But not only that, say you were to ask, how does this one thing relate to other things? Then you're really in trouble. Because there's an infinite number of relationships. Right? And so you're lost in a swarm. Right? So what you find is in your quest for knowing one thing here, all you do is end up more and more ignorant. So that's why they say, there's beautiful verses in the Sanskrit, that the most humble person is in the most humble person is the pundit, the scholar. Because for the scholar is somebody who's studying all the time, right? And the nature of knowledge is this, that the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know. Right? The example Swamiji uses is if you have a little flashlight with letting out just a little beam of light, right? You're illumining a small circumference of darkness with your little beam of light. Right? It's like a little intellect. It's illuminating. Say you have a huge spotlight. Now look at how much darkness you're illuminating. And so the more you know in the world, you're opening up vistas and vistas, more and more knowledge of what you don't know. Right? You have something that you do know, but everything that you know leaves a boundary around it of what you don't know. And so the more you know, the more you don't know. Right? So here, to gain knowledge of one thing, knowing which everything is as well known, right, cannot be a knowledge of an object in the creation. Because that's an impossibility. And then just on a very simple level, one object is not another. Right? And so if I want to know the one thing knowing which all things are known, we get to the relationship, what we call satyam and mitya. That's the only escape from this. Satyam and mitya means this. A couple of steps here. Knowing one thing, all things are known. That means, first of all, if that is so, as the Upanishads say, the one thing, first of all, has to truly be one thing. It means no parts. Because any one thing out here, we say it's a thing, but when we analyze it, it's made of an infinite number of parts. This is not one thing at all. It's a conglomerate that we call a thing, but it's not one thing at all. And so therefore we can't know it. All we can do is kind of know it in a way that's useful to us. That's it. But if we want to know one thing has to be there to know. There has to be one thing to know. And that one thing, therefore, has to be without any parts. It has to be one without a second. Indivisible. If it's indivisible, let's just look indivisible first. Indivisible, it has no parts. Then when you know it, you know it. Because you're not knowing a part of it. You're not knowing the this cell or that cell, right? Or the right side or the left side. You know it because it is only one. It's not divisible. It doesn't have parts. So when you know it, you know it. But now, if you know this thing that is one, it has no parts, and by knowing that, you know everything else, right? Then that one thing has to be the clay of the pot. It has to be the being of all of this. It has to be the very substance of all of this, in the same way that the clay is the substance of the pot, or the gold is the substance of ornaments. But if that were to be so, if there is one thing knowing which all things are known, right, then that one thing has to not only be the substance of all of these things that we experience, it has to be changeless. In spite of experiencing all of these things, it has to be the self, the being of all of these things, and it has to be changeless. Because if it's not changeless, then we can't know it. It's got parts. And if it's changing, it's got parts. We knew it for a second, and then it changed to something else. It's got parts. And so, now, what that would mean then is to know the truth of all of this, the one thing that is the truth of all of this, we have to move into this relationship of satyam and mitya, where the very being of all of these names and forms, the very being of all of these names and forms, is the nature of the subject, which cannot be objectified, and has to be the very adhishtana, what we call the adhishtana, of all of this that changes. So this is the relationship that this Upanishad now has to unfold. It's setting it up. This question is a huge question. There's no way to understand this question, to answer this question, without understanding this relationship of the satyam to the mitya. Satyam, the word satyam, means that which actually exists in past, present, or future. That which is not subject to time. That which is, but is not subject to time. Right? It exists in past, present, or future. Can never be mitigated. That's satyam. Mitya is that all that we experience that is bound by time. The definition of it, mitya, sada sadbhyam anirvachaniya. That which can't be defined as satyam or as non-existent, which is this entire creation. We have to analyze now this entire creation to see if it has any being of its own apart from that which we call satyam. And what we find is that there isn't. That this creation has no being apart from that which is satyam, and that which is satyam I discovered to be myself, to be the one without a second. That's the whole teaching now that Upanishad has to unveil. But here, so now, let's look at it. Shaunaka has approached Angirasam, and he's asked him this, hey Bhagavan, according to Vidhi, everything's all Shraddha, he says, what is that one thing? knowing which all things are known. And so then, Angirasan kind of answers him. Let's look at that. In a roundabout way. So the way he answers him is actually really important. Tasmai sa huvacha dvevidye veditavye iti hasma yad brahma viddo vadanti para chaiva paracha tasmai sa hovacha dvevidye veditavye iti hasma yad brahma viddo vadanti para chaiva paracha. So tasmai sa ha uvacha. Tasmai saha ha uvacha. Tasmai saha uvacha. Dve vidye veditavye iti ha sma yet brahma viddha vadanti para cha eva apara cha. Tasmai saha uvacha. To him, he uvacha, saha, he uvacha, he said. Ha means kila. Kila can be mean verily, or as the story goes, as the tradition goes. Okay. So as the tradition goes, sa uvacha, he said tasmai to him, to Shanaka. Dvevidye veditavye. Two knowledges, veditavye, are to be known. There are two knowledges to be known, which are to be known. Iti thus, hasma, verily, as it has been told, yad brahmavidha varanti, which the brahmavids, those who know Brahma, now here, yad brahmavidha varanti. Brahmavidha is in the nominative form from brahmavid. The brahmavids know. The brahmavids varanti, they say. The brahmavids here are those who, where Brahman can be, the Vedas, those who are the knowers of the Veda, but those who know the artha of the Veda. In the Shankara says here, it's a really nice little thing, he says, Vedartha abhijnaha. Those who know the meaning. Those who know the essence of the Vedas, Vedarta. Vedarta abhijnaha. Parama artha darshinaha. Those who have the vision, darshinaha. The vision of the Paramatma. Of the truth of yourself. Of the self which is limitless. So those who know the essence of the Vedas, the Brahmavids, who know the essence of the Vedas. And who have the vision of the Paramatma. The limitless, the self which is limitless. So those people, they say, there are these two knowledges which are to be known. Paracha, eva aparacha. Para and apara. Called the higher and the lower, right? Para, higher or supreme, and apara, lower. So what are the higher and the lower? Let's look and see. So, tatra, next verse. Now that you stopped me, I think actually I'll say. Thank you, Ed. I think I'll say something about this just when I want to. No. This is good. I forgot to say something I wanted to say here. This answer is not exactly what Shaunaka had asked, right? He had asked, you know, please tell me knowing that one thing, knowing which all things are known. And so Angirasana says, well, there's two knowledges to be known. There are two things to be known. One is the aparavidya, one is the paravidya. Paravidya, aparavidya. Now, why not directly answer? Right. There's a teaching methodology that's contained, that underlies this verse. The teaching methodology is this. You need to negate what is not real before you present what is real. You need to negate the doubts, a person's doubts, a person's conclusions, a person's beliefs, before you give what we call the Siddhanta, that which is the vision that the Upanishad has to give. Because if you don't do that, if you don't first negate a person's the validity or refute a person's conclusions, then even though you're presenting, you're answering to the student what the student asks, what comes into the student's mind is that those words that you're unfolding are hitting the doubts in the student's minds, or the conclusions in the student's mind. And so, in fact, they're bouncing off. Right? They bounce off. So this is why, and there's a teaching methodology called Purvapaksha Siddhanta. Right? And we follow that in teaching, the Purvapaksha Siddhanta. The Purvapaksha is what is, and the teacher will look at this, so you should, those of you who eventually be teaching, should think about this, really. Even if you're teaching anything, not even just Vedanta, but anything. You want to make somebody understand something. First, if you make clear to them what they already think to be true, what are they already thinking? What do they think right now is the truth about a given thing? What is their conclusion right now? That conclusion that they have, and there are many of them, right? And the teacher knows what many, 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 many of those conclusions are. So you pick one of them, okay? And say if it's an individual, then you definitely know it's up at one and one, you know, okay? So now you take that conclusion, and you make that conclusion that the student has very clear, so that you both know that each of you understands what that conclusion is. Because otherwise, the student will just say, well, no, you don't really understand what I mean. So the teacher actually has to be patient and diligent and serious about understanding what the student actually does think and what the student actually does mean. And so on the part of the teacher, if the situation is such, you can ask a lot of questions to really try to understand what the student means. And so now, both the teacher and the student are clear about what the doubt is. That's the Purvapaksha, has been now stated, right? Both are clear. Now that Purvapaksha, once it's stated, has to be answered. Now, not with what the Siddhanta is, not with what the Vedanta has to say, yet, but the fallacies in that Purvapaksha means the first side. Purva means first. Paksha means side. Okay, so the student has a side. That's a Purvapaksha. That has to first be clearly understood by both, and then the fallacies of that Purvapaksha have to be clearly shown. The fallacies in the thinking, the illogic, whatever the problems are in that particular position, needs to be shown so that both student and teacher see that. Right? Now this Purvapaksha has been answered. When the Purva Paksha has been answered, then there is room in the mind of the student for the Siddhanta. Okay? So now, Shaunaka is a great Mahashala, right? He has studied all of the Vedas. Right? He has studied Dharma and Adharma. He knows what that is. He knows what is Dharma, he knows what is Adharma. He has lived a life of the householder, doing all of the rituals and all of the duties that have been prescribed. All of it he has done really properly. And so he has tremendous Shraddha, right, in the Vedas. And so now he's coming to gain knowledge, which are also in the Upanishads. But what is the relationship of the knowledge in the Upanishads, which Shaunaka has now approached Angirasam and asked for? What is the relationship of this knowledge in the Upanishads to the Vedas, which is the world out of which Shaunaka is coming, right? And so, remember, Shaunaka is a Mahashala. He knows the Vedas, he knows the rituals, he's got Shraddha, he's lived his life within the Vedic worldview. Okay? So he approaches Angirasam. So what does Angirasam say? There are two knowledges which have to be known. One is Aparavidya, and one is Paravidya. You need to know both of these. Right? One is the lower, one is the higher. These two need to be known. And so now he says, so this is why this is happening here. So now let's go to the next verse. Tetrapara Rigvedo Yajurvedaha Samavedaha Atharvavedaha Shiksha Kalpo Vyakaranam Niruktam Chandaha Jyotishamiti Eta Parayaya Tereksharam Adigamyate. There are the two knowledges that need to be known, Tetra. Apara, I'll read it with the Sandhi. Tetra, Apara, Rigvedaha, Yajurvedaha, Samavedaha, Atharvavedaha, Shiksha, Kalpaha, Vyakaranam, Niruktam, Chandas, Jyotishamiti. All of these are Apara. Eta now, Para. Yaya, Eta, Para, Yaya, Ted, Aksharam, Adigamite. It says, now there, when I say there's two knowledges to be known, Para and Apara, this is the Apara. This is the lower, the Apara. The Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Samaveda, the Atharvaveda. All of the four Vedas are Apara. Okay? Not only that, Shiksha, Kalpa, Vyakaranam, Niruktam, Chandas, Jyotisham. These six are called the Sharangas. Sharangas means the six limbs that are necessary, six limbs they're auxiliary subject matters or teachings or you call it sciences, things that you need to know to be able to properly study the Vedas. So the first one is Shiksha. Shiksha is the pronunciation, how to pronounce a letter, a varna, a letter. For instance, that you know there's the letter A and A that you know that there's extra, actually, say you take one letter, like a vowel, the vowel there's hraswa, short, then the long, then pluta, there's also in chanting, there's a long, okay? You have to know that there are the swaras. You know, when we're practicing these chants, when you see the vertical lines on the top, those are called udata. You have to know those are tones. Then there's letters that have no line, right? That's swarita, that's in the middle. Anudata, those are the horizontal lines underneath, right? Those are the three tones, the basic three tones for chanting. So now, knowing the proper pronunciation of the sounds, right? And then knowing the swaras, the tones, all of that is part of shiksha. What's so interesting in the Sanskrit, it's learning the sound, and then that sound that you learn is going to be represented by a symbol. It's one sound, one symbol. So not like English, you know, where there's many sounds. You can't say, oh, this symbol is going to be pronounced in this way. No. But in Sanskrit, it's the shiksha has to do with the proper pronunciation of the sound. Right? And then that sound is going to be represented by a symbol. So proper pronunciation is called the shiksha, necessary for chanting. Kulpa. The kulpa, there are many rituals to learn how to do the ritual, what mantras to use for a given ritual, what things are to be offered, what sequence of mantras, all of that. So learning all the ins and outs of what's to be done for the performance of a ritual, how to do it, you know, and what mantras to use for a given ritual. That's called kulpa. So these are science in themselves. Vyakarana. Vyakarana is grammar, the Sanskrit grammar. The Panini Grammar Sutras, you know, where the words you're able, if you know the grammar in Sanskrit, when you see a word, you're able to break that word. The word will just fall apart for you into its components. The word will break into its verbal root that we call the dhatu, right? And all of the upasargas, which are the prepositions that will go before the root. And the different types of terminations, all of that you see clearly. The Vyakaranam will tell you that, and what the place of a word, how the word fits into a given sentence. So the grammar, in the Sanskrit, grammar is extremely beautiful and sophisticated. Sanskrit is the Devanagari script is called, that's just the script, but it means the city of the gods. It's the language language for the city of the gods that comes from the city of the gods. And Sanskrit, the language itself, is kind of viewed as the language of the gods. And when you study it, the more you realize the infinite beauty and intelligence of the language. And the language continues to amaze you in the beauty of its structure. If you know one verbal root, for instance, like the word buddh, to know, buddh, and you know guna and vriddhi in certain Sanskrit rules, that word can just sprout into 20, 30 words because you know a few rules. And so that's the vyakarana. It makes all of the language clear to you. And takes everything, breaks it all back into its verbal roots and the whole structure of the language. Niruktam, the niruktas actually have one. It's a dictionary. It's like it's in verse, but it's the etymology of all of the words. It takes the words back to the roots and back to their beginnings. So it's a type of dictionary, niruktam. Chandas. Chandas is prosody, the different meters for, like, the different shlokas can be chanted in a lot of different meters. And then Jyotisham. Jyotisham is a combination in the West between, in India it's not a combination, but in the West it'd be a combination of astronomy and astrology. And it's an integral part for a Hindu or for a Vedic life. Astrology is not at all removed, because everything that you do is very related to Ishvara and related to the heavens. And so all your beginnings, you know, who you marry, what is good for you at a given time, all of these things are very clearly delineated in Jyotish, in astrology. Swamiji said in his book that I was reading, he said something very interesting also. He said, it's not as though, he says, it's a person is very related to the heavens. Everybody has their astrology chart done, you know, and it's just a given. It's a given. When you're born, you have your chart done. You know, and if anything, any pratibandhikas or obstructions that might be there, that is often pointed out so that proper rituals and things can be done at a time when it looks like things might be not going well. So those things will be looked for and taken care of. Oh, when your daughter's 14 years old, she needs, there's a little rough spot there, these rituals and whatnot should be done. So those things are taken care of. Then fine, all's well. Of course, if you were to get married, you would match the charts and all of that. That would be a given. You would never just marry somebody. You would match the charts. Well, of course, if you have that shraddha, if you have that shraddha that you are part of this creation, you know, then the position of the stars, you know, is meaningful. So it's a very ancient, ancient science, and there's a certain shraddha in that. But what I was interested in, Swamiji saying, and I hadn't thought of it like this before, then life goes on. Okay, it's only when something is not going well. So life is going on, all is well. Then all of a sudden, nothing is going well. Nothing is going your way. You're beating your head against the wall. Everything seems to be going wrong. At that time, you'll go to an astrologer. You'll look at the chart and see, there must be something obstructing me here. There must be some sort of an obstruction. Then you go to an astrologer, and the astrologer will look at it and say, yes, this is, and that is a problem here. You should do these particular pujas, these particular homas, these particular rituals, these particular prayers in order to neutralize that negative, the negative effect that we see there. That's when you do that. And then whatever homas and rituals and whatnot the person will tell, then you get those done in order to dispel the subtle effects of the karma to whatever degree you can. And so that's something that is done as a matter of course. You know, Swamiji will do that. If one of his students or one of his devotees is having some sort of a problem, he'll want to take a look at the chart and see if there's something there that points to that. You know, and if it's something serious, like some continual obstacle, he'll call in somebody to do what's called a prashna and various different things to see. You know, and then what is prescribed to take care of that particular obstruction that we call daivam, you know, something that can be obstructing on a subtle level. What are some pujas and rituals to do? And then have those done. He'll say, have those done. And he'll have his own sankalpa, his own prayer, but have those done. You know? Because that's all, again, shraddha. Shraddha in the efficacy of the Vedas, shraddha in the efficacy of rituals, and understanding that there is your prayatna, your efforts, the efforts that you make in order to accomplish something, but there's also daivam. You know, there's also, you know, that third factor that can make things seem unequal. Like, for instance, one person is doing two people are making as though the same effort. You know, same situation, same effort. One person, it all works so beautifully. Everything works, and they're so successful. The other person, just as intelligent, just as much opportunity, everything he does, banging the head on the wall. It never works, it never works, it never works. This other person sailing along. So this guy says, oh my God, what is, there must be some divam, there must be some third factor here. Let me see what that is. And then gets rituals done to try to break it up as much as possible. That's Jyotisham. You know? I mean, that's a little bit of Jyotisham. It's a huge, it's not, I mean, it's a major science. It's very ancient and taken, it's just very, very much a part of the Vedic life. You know, and at least for the culture that I've been brought up with Swamiji and with that, you know, cultural world there, it's very much a part of the of Vedic life, even when certain rituals are performed, you know, even not if it's even for a given particular purpose, just when, what time of year, what time of the month it is, there's certain rituals to be performed, you know, because there's a relationship with the whole. Just like you have, if you have a relationship with Ishvara, you know, then you have a relationship also with the whole. So there's that consciousness in Jyotisham. But that's all part of aparavidya. Now another thing, I'm just going to go, and we're going to have to finish this next week. So I'll tell you what the, there's a lot to be said about this, but I'll just finish at least translating the verse. And then he says, now and then, the atta, and then, the paravidya, is that yaya by which that aksharam, that which is aksharam, aksharam means that which can never be destroyed, never wanes, can never change, tad aksharam adigamyate, that by which that which is aksharam is adigamyate, is gained. That by which is that aksharam, Brahman, adigamyate, is gained. What exactly they mean by is gained and all that, we'll see. We'll see next week. Okay. Let's stop there.
Oh, that was so beautiful.
You're welcome. Let's just take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Actually, because it seems to be so relevant to take care of living a dharmic life, and at the same time, it seems also that you know, when we approach the teaching from a more psychological approach. approach, which we kind of tend to do, I think, or psycho-spiritual approach, maybe, that we take in the West. And because of not being familiar with this huge body of ritualization, is that then okay to just say, well, this just doesn't fit quite into this culture, so we just leave that out. We don't really need to do that. But then the question is, how do we bring in those Dharmic measures that in a way seem to also fulfill a certain purpose in plowing the ground, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
That's the question.
And I think that we all, every culture has its karmakanda, in a sense. It doesn't have the same, maybe the same clarity of structure, but all cultures, for the most part, have a religion. And from what I've studied, from almost all of the religions, the certain value system is the same. Don't steal, do not kill, do not steal, don't commit adultery, and don't be covetous. Our Ten Commandments are don't just belong to the Christians or to the Jews. You know, you find versions of these Ten Commandments in all of the different religions and spiritualities. Then we all have our own Dharma. We all have the golden rule, do unto others, like that. We all have a value, for instance, that is almost inborn innate value. For instance, if you're married, you shouldn't cheat on your wife or husband. There's a certain sanctity in the marriage vows. People break it and then they feel guilty. Okay. At least they used to. there's a certain inborn innate duties toward taking care of the children, providing a home. So there is a structure. Right? The structure and the understanding of the reason for the structure and the religiosity of the structure, or where the culture and the religion are one and the same, that's very weak now, you know. So hopefully with your upbringing, with your parents, with your community, there's been a dharmic structure that gives you a value system that makes you hold in check your ragas and dveshas, your likes and dislikes, so that there's some value greater than just yourself. A person who's got a what we call in psychology a narcissistic personality disorder is a person. They have nothing holding them that's any greater than themselves. And so if I want this, I should have it. Mm-hmm. End of story. If I don't want this, I should get rid of it. End of story. Nothing holding. Nothing greater than themselves holding. Now, in the Vedic culture, there's a very, very well-defined structure. We don't have that well-defined structure. But we still have a structure, and we still have the Sadharana Dharma, you know, that general golden rule. And we still have do's and don'ts in terms of our commitments to others, you know, that hold us in check. Now, what I find, because of, like, for me, studying the Vedanta, studying the Vedas from a distance. I don't actually go into the Vedas themselves and study, but I study, I learn so much about it from reading the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and all of these things. I continue to gain more and more strength of knowledge that supports the reason for the value, the reason for the structure. That's why I always want everybody to read that book of Swamiji's, Value of Values. I love that book. I give it to all my students at CIS. Yeah. Well, yeah. I'll give you one. Do you have one? Yeah. It's the best. Oh, it's so good. It's so good because it makes you understand why that structure is important. So you don't just have a value because somebody told you. You have a value because you understand the shanti, the strength that it gives for your mind. So we have the structure, and the structure is basically a human structure. You know, that in some form in India, there's some ways it's ritualized and made very, very clear. But we have it. And that's why it's easy to, in some ways, when you're studying India, which is an ancient culture, it's even ancient to India, Vedic India compared to modern India. But no matter who you are, if you're studying it, you will resonate with it. You can translate. Does that make sense?
Yeah. This relationship of Pramakanda to Jnana, on the one hand, it said that karma can't lead to knowledge, action doesn't lead to knowledge. On the other hand, it seems that there's the prerequisite that you have a certain amount of dharmic discipline and self-discipline and so forth. So
that's exactly right.
Completely independent of
they're not. They're independent and they're not independent, because these are the two words, little phrases that are helpful. Upayanishta and upayanishta. Upayanishta means getting nishta, firmness in the means of knowledge. The means that you need in order to be able to gain knowledge. That's your mind. Your body, your mind, your sense organs, they need to be clean and strong, able to think logically, able to have a certain amount of shanti. That upayanishta, getting that strength, then karma, rituals, dharma, the way you treat others, all of that, right, comes into play there. And that's why the karmakanda is so important. That's where even doing pranayama, hatha yoga, following dharma, giving gifts, doing charities, all of these type of things are very, very important and useful. And that's why this Mahashalaha for Shaunaka, as a great Mahashalaha, that's why that has come in, because that allowed him to gain the Antakarna Shuddhi that gives the Upayanishta, so that that mind is then capable of what we call Upayanishta. Upayanishta is that which is to be known, which is you gain through Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. Shravana means exposure to the teaching. Manana means with your mind, thinking it through, understanding it. All of your doubts cleared, all of that. And Nididhyasana is the owning it through meditation, or owning what you've seen at the time of teaching is Nididhyasana. That's Upayanishta. So it's not at all that the different karmas or rituals or things that we, or yoga or meditation or anything, it's not at all that they're not useful. They're extremely useful. But they're useful for bringing about the type of mind and attitude that is necessary to be able to gain this knowledge. But it's a very important distinction, because if you don't make that distinction, then what you think, oh, let me sit and meditate, or let me do yoga asanas, and more, let me do more, and more, and more, and more, and more, because they will eventually culminate in knowledge. They don't culminate in knowledge. They culminate in a healthy body and a quiet mind, which is then available for knowledge, but they don't themselves culminate in knowledge. And if you think that you do, they do, then you're practicing these things, and it's like the horizon, you will never get there. You'll get a healthier and healthier and healthier body, and healthier and healthier and healthier, and quieter and quieter and quieter and quieter, quieter mind, and quieter and quieter and quieter, that still doesn't know who I am. It still doesn't know I am the whole. I have such a quiet mind, and I don't know who I am. That's huge. That's a very... It's really... That if you get that, that's so much changes when you understand that.